Let's read stories of Sherlock Holmes. The Boscombe Valley Mystery, Chapter 1, An Ordinary Crime. My name is Dr. Watson, and I have the good fortune to be the friend and companion of Sherlock Holmes. I try to keep a record of the cases he has solved. I have been with him many times when he has solved cases with just a few clues and his powerful brain. One such case was the Boscombe Valley Mystery. I knew nothing about it until I got a telegram early one morning at home. It was from Holmes asking me to go with them to the west of England. My wants are few and simple, so I very swiftly packed the case, said farewell to my wife, and was at Paddington in less than an hour. Holmes was pacing up and down the platform. He was instantly recognizable, tall and gaunt, and dressed in his long grey cloak and deerstalker hat. It is really very good you to come, Watson. I need someone I can rely on. We had the carriage to ourselves, and Holmes spent the time reading through a huge pile of newspapers. Now and then he stopped to make notes and to think. Finally, he rolled the papers into a ball and threw them onto the luggage rack. "Have you heard anything of the case?" he asked. "Not a word. I've not seen a paper for days." "Hmm," said Holmes. "It's one of those simple cases which are so extremely difficult."
"What do you mean?"
"The more ordinary a crime seems to be, the more difficult it is to see the solution. It is the unusual which makes things easy."
"What kind of crime are we dealing with?"
"Murder, Watson. A serious case has already been made against the son of the murdered man. It happened in Boscombe Valley, near Hereford. The owner of much land in the area is Mr. John Turner. He came back from Australia a few years ago and settled here. Made his fortune, did he? Enough to buy several farms. One he let out to another Australian, Mr. Charles McCarthy. McCarthy has a son of 18 called James."
"Are there no wives?" I asked.
"Neither of the wives still living, but Turner has one daughter of similar age to James."
"And the murder?"
"It seems that last Monday McCarthy left his house at Heatherley at about 3 in the afternoon. He walked down to Boscombe Pool, a small lake at the end of Boscombe Valley. He told his servant that he had an appointment at 3 o'clock and never came back alive. McCarthy was seen walking towards the pool by two people. Both say he was walking alone. The gamekeeper also says that a few minutes later, James McCarthy went the same way, carrying a gun. He thought the son was following his father."
"And was the father shot?" I asked.
"Oh, no," replied Holmes. "Please wait. There was another witness. Patience Moran, daughter of the lodgekeeper, and on the Boscombe estate, was picking flowers in the woods. She says that she saw James and his father having a violent quarrel. She heard Charles McCarthy using strong language to his son, and she saw the son raise his hand as if to strike his father."
Holmes continued.
"She ran away and told her mother almost as soon as she had finished telling her story. James McCarthy ran up and said he had found his father dead. They followed him and found the body by the side of the pool. The head had been beaten by blows from some heavy and blunt weapon."
"Such as the butt end of a gun?" I asked.
"Exactly. Anyway, Watson, James McCarthy has been arrested and charged with his father's murder. It looks exceedingly grave against the young man."
"Has he said anything?"
"Indeed he has, and it makes an interesting case. According to James McCarthy, he had been away in Bristol for 3 days. He came back to find his father out. He set out to do some rabbit shooting at the other side of the Boscombe Pool. About 100 yards from the pool, he heard a cry of "Cooey," which was a usual signal between him and his father. His father was surprised to see him. For some reason, an argument took place and James walked off.
He had not gone for when he heard a dreadful cry. According to his story, he returned and found his father dying. He held him in his arm, but he could do nothing. He then ran off to the lodgekeeper's for help.
Is there nothing else to go on? I asked.
Two things which may turn out to be important, said Holmes. James heard his father speak before he died. He said he spoke about a rat.
A rat.
Precisely, my dear Watson, and the other matter was the subject of the quarrel.
Which was?
James McCarthy refused to tell the coroner what they quarreled about.
Refused?
Quite so.
Holmes looked up at me, raised the eyebrows, and smiled.
You see why I'm interested, Watson. This is not such a simple case as they would have us believe.
Chapter 2. A Blow from Behind. We arrived at the Hereford Arms in Ross at 4:30. We were sipping our tea when the door burst open and in rushed one of the loveliest young women I have ever seen.
Oh, Mr. Sherlock Holmes, she cried. I'm so glad you have come. I know that James didn't do it. We have known each other since we were children. He's too tender-hearted to hurt a fly.
You may rely on my doing all that I can, replied Holmes, deducing correctly that the lady was Mr. Turner's daughter, Alice.
James never did it, she repeated. And about his quarrel with his father, I am sure he refused to speak of it because it concerned me.
In what way?
Mr. McCarthy wanted James to marry me. We have always loved one another like brother and sister. But James is so young and he is not willing to commit himself to such a step.
She blushed and I deduced that she would not object to marrying him, however.
Thank you, said Holmes. And may I see your father tomorrow?
I'm afraid the doctor won't allow it.
The doctor?
Have you not heard? Poor father has not been strong for years, but this has made him quite ill. He was such a strong man once when he was in Australia. Mr. McCarthy was the only man who knew him in those days.
Really? Said Holmes. That is interesting. Thank you, Miss Turner. You have been a great help.
She smiled gratefully at him.
I must go home now. Father misses me so if I leave him.
She hurried from the room as impulsively as she had entered. Holmes decided to set off for Hereford immediately to see James McCarthy, and while he was away, I pondered the details of the murder. The local paper had full inquest report, which included the surgeon's description of the injuries. The bones on the left-hand side of the skull at the back had been shattered by a heavy blow. This gave me pause for thought. Such a blow must have been struck from behind, which is not what you would expect in a face-to-face argument. Then there was the matter of the man's dying words. A rat. What could it mean? Holmes returned late without much more information. He had found out, though, the truth about James' feelings towards Miss Turner.
He is madly in love with her, remarked Holmes.
Then why argue with his father about the match?
Because Watson is already married.
Great heavens, Holmes, he's hardly more than a boy.
And he was even more of a boy when he got himself into the clutches of a barmaid in Bristol. He married her secretly over a year ago when Miss Turner was away at boarding school.
So he's being scolded for not doing what he would love to do. How mattering.
Quite so. However good may come of this evil, it seems that the barmaid found out it was in serious trouble. She was throwing him over. She has written to say that she has a husband already in the Bermuda dockyard.
So there is no tie between them?
Happily so, but a small comfort for being in prison on a murder charge.
But if he is innocent, who has done it?
Let me draw your attention to two things, Watson. First, the murdered man had an appointment with someone. That person could not have been his son. His son was away and he didn't know when he was returning.
Of course. And the second thing,
the murdered man was heard to cry Cooey! Before he knew his son was anywhere near, the case depends upon such things. Holmes closed his eyes and would say no more.
Chapter 3. The Scene of the Crime.
The following morning, we set off for Heatherly Farm and the Boscombe Pool. As the carriage bounced down the country lanes, Holmes turned to me.
One another interesting fact, Watson. Mr. McCarthy lived at Heatherly Farm rent-free.
How very generous of Mr. Turner, I replied. But then they were friends from Australia.
Does it not seem odd, though? McCarthy, who had so little of his own, talked of marrying his son to Turner's daughter. He talked of it in a very confident way, but I have discovered that Turner himself was against it.
It did seem odd, but I could deduce nothing from it. We soon arrived at the farm, a comfortable-looking two-story building. The maid at Holmes' request showed us the boots McCarthy had been wearing. She also found a pair of his son's boots. Holmes measured them all very carefully and then set off to the pool. It was damp, marshy ground, and there were marks of many feet on the path and on the short grass beside it.
How simple it would have been, exclaimed Holmes, if I had been here before they came like a herd of buffalo. Many of the important tracks have been obscured.
He peered at the ground, then cried,
Aha! Here are three separate tracks of the same feet.
He took out a lens and lay down to get a better view, all of the time talking to himself.
These are young McCarthy feet. Twice he was walking and once he ran swiftly. The soles are deeply marked, but the heels hardly visible. That bears out a story. Here are the father's feet as he paced up and down. Ha! What have we here? Tiptoes. Tiptoes square two. Quite unusual boots. Now, where did they come from?
Holmes paced up and down, sometimes losing and sometimes finding the track. He stopped in the edge of the wood and under the shadow of a great beech tree. He lay down again. He stayed there a long time, turning over leaves and dry twigs. A jagged stone was lying among the moss. He picked it up and examined it carefully. Then he got up and followed a pathway through the woods, which led to the main road, where he stopped. He showed me to the stone.
This may interest you, he said. If I am not mistaken, the murder was done with it.
He did not sound as if he expected to be mistaken, but I had to ask, how can you tell? There are no marks on it.
The grass was growing under it, so it had only been there a few days. It matches the injuries, and there is no sign of another weapon.
And the murderer?
The murderer is a tall man, left-handed. He limps with the right leg and wears thick-soled shooting boots. He smokes Indian cigars, uses a cigar holder, and he carries a blunt penknife. There are several other indications, but this may be enough to aid us in our search.
Holmes was silent for a long time, and we did not speak again until we were back at the Hereford Arms.
Chapter 4. A Rat.
After lunch, Holmes sat with his tapering fingers together, staring into space. Then he turned to me.
I don't know quite what to do, Watson. I should value your advice. Let me explain.
Pray do so.
Let us presume that what young James said was true.
In what respect?
About two things in particular. One, I mentioned earlier that his father called Cooey before seeing him. The other was McCarthy's dying words about a rat.
What are these Cooey, then?
It could not have been meant for his son. As far as McCarthy knew, his son was in Bristol. The Cooey was meant to call the person he was meeting, but Cooey is an Australian greeting, hence he was expecting to meet someone from Australia.
I nodded. And the rat? Holmes took out a folded paper from his pocket.
This is a map of the colony of Victoria in Australia. I had it sent over this morning.
He put his hand over part of the map.
What do you read?
A rat, I said. And now he raised his hand. I could see the whole word. Blarat.
Quite so. That was the word that McCarthy spoke. His son heard the last part only. He was trying to say the name of his murderer. So and so of Blarat.
That's wonderful.
It's obvious now, you see, I have narrowed down the field. A tall Australian who is at home in the district, at home enough to find his way through the back of the state.
His height you deduced from the length of his stride and his boots. But what about his leanness?
The mark of his right foot was always less clear than his left. He put less weight on it. Why? Because he limped.
But his left-handedness?
You notice the injury as reported at inquest. A blow struck from behind, yet from the left side. Surely a left-handed man stood behind the tree during the argument between James and his father. Even a smoke there. I found the ash of a cigar. As you know, I'm an expert on tobacco ash. I then discovered the cigar stump in the moss where he had thrown it.
And the cigar holder?
The cigar had not been in his mouth, therefore he had used a holder. The tip had been cut off, not beaten. It was not a clean cut, so I deduced a blunt penknife.
I see where this all points. The murderer must be...
Mr. John Turner!
Cried a voice. It was a hotel waiter opening the door. He showed a visitor into the room. The man who entered was a strange and impressive figure. He had a slow, limping step, but his craggy face and huge arms and legs gave an impression of strength of body and character. His face was white and his lips tanged with the blue. As a doctor, I could see that it was a very ill man.
"Pray, take a seat," said Holmes. "You got my note?"
"The lodgekeeper brought it. You said you wished to see me here to avoid scandal."
"I thought people would talk if I came to the hall."
"And why did you wish to see me?"
the man asked wearily.
"I know all about McCarthy," said Holmes. The old man sunk his face in his hands.
"God help me!" "But I would have spoken out. I would not have let that young man come to harm."
"I am glad to hear it," said Holmes gravely.
"I would have spoken of it already, but my dear daughter, it will break her heart when she sees me arrested."
"It may not come to that," said Holmes.
"What?
I am no police officer. Your daughter invited me here, and I am acting in her interests. Young McCarthy must be got off, however."
"I am a dying man,"
said Turner.
"The doctor says I have but a month, yet I would sooner die under my own roof than in jail."
"Just tell us the truth while I got down the facts. You will sign it with Watson as witness. If the case goes against young McCarthy, I shall use a confession. You may be assured I shall not use it unless it is absolutely needed."
"It's as well," said the old man.
"I doubt I shall live until the trial, but I would still like to spare Alice the shock. I will tell you all. It will not take long."
Chapter 5. A Riddle Answered.
"This man McCarthy was a devil. His grip has been upon me these 20 years. He has blasted my life. It began in the 1960s at the gold diggings. I was young and hot-blooded, but I had no luck with my search for gold. I took to drink and made bad friends. I became a highway
A robber. There were six of us, and we had a wild free life. Black Jack of Ballarat was the name I took. One day, a gold convoy came from Ballarat to Melbourne. We tagged it, and in the fight, three of our boys were killed before we got the swap. I put my pistol to the head of the driver. It was this man, McCarthy. I wished to the Lord I had shot him then. We got away with the gold and became wealthy men. Later, I made my way to England. I wanted to settle down and do some good with my money to make up for the way I had earned. I married, and though my wife died young, she left me with darling daughter Alice. I did my best to lead a good life and to make up for my past. All was going well until McCarthy laid his grip up on me. I had gone to London on business. There in Regent Street, I met him. He had hardly a coat on his back or a boot to his foot.
"Well, here we are, Jack," he said. "We'll be as good as family to you, me and my son. You can have the keeping of us. And if you don't, it's a fine law, a barren country, and there's always the police."
Well, they came down here, and there was no shaking them off. They lived rent-free and heavily on my best land. There was no rest, no peace, no forgetfulness. Turned where I would, there was his cunning, grinning face at my elbow. It grew worse as Alice grew up. He saw that I was more afraid of her knowing my past than I was about to police. Whatever he wanted, I gave without question. Land, money, houses, until at last he asked what I could not give. He asked for Alice. His son had grown up. It seemed a great stroke to him to marry his son to my girl. I was ill, and when I died, his family would take the whole property. But I was firm. I would not do it. I did not dislike the lad, but the McCarthy blood was in him, and that was enough. McCarthy threatened me. I braved him to do his worst. Finally, we were to meet at the pool midway between our houses to talk it out. I went down and heard him talking with his son. I smoked a cigar and waited in the trees till he was alone, but as I listened, all that was dark and bitter in me seemed to come uppermost. He was urging his son to marry Alice with no regard for what she might feel. It drove me mad to think that I and all that I hold most dear should be in the power of such a man. I had to silence his full tongue. I did it, Mr. Holmes. I struck him down like a venomous beast. That is the truth, gentlemen, of what occurred.
"It's not for me to judge you," said Holmes as Turner signed the statement. "You know that you are to answer for your deeds at a higher court than ours."
"Farewell then," said the old man. "Your own deathbeds, when they come, will be easier for the thought of the peace which you have given to mine."
He stumbled slowly from the room. "God help us," said Holmes after a long silence. "Why does fate play such tricks with poor helpless worms?" James McCarthy was acquitted at the trial, mainly because of the evidence presented by Holmes to the defense. Old Turner lived another 7 months. There is now every chance that James and Alice may yet live happily together, in ignorance of the cloud which rests upon their past.
I hope you enjoyed it.